of his previous collections. And to introduce all of you as distinguished leaders at the university and in the community and retired public officials, to Mr. Farenkopf, and to introduce him to you. As most of you know, was chairman of the Republican National Committee from 1983 until the accession of Mr. Atwater as chairman. He's currently a member of the law firm, the oldest firm in Washington, Hogan and Hartson. He was born in Brooklyn, but quickly escaped. spent most of his childhood in the Lake Tahoe region in Nevada. He received his bachelor's degree from the university there, and then went on for legal education at Bolt Hall, University of California, where he received the JD degree in law. He practiced law in Nevada, was held various positions, judge pro tem for a time in the Reno Municipal Court. He taught law, criminal law. Was also soon thereafter chairman of the Nevada Republican Committee from 1975 to 1983. He was a delegate to the Republican National Convention in 72, 76, and 80, probably more.
488.
National chairman of the Republican State Chairman's Association. Member of the board of such groups as National Endowment for Democracy and the American Political Foundation. He's been the recipient of numerous awards, including the Distinguished Service Award of the USJCs and the Humanitarian Award of the National Council of Christians and Jews. He continues to be cited as someone who brought a new concept of political leadership and the organization of campaigns and the political party to the Republican Party, and we're delighted that in a busy time and a busy schedule he's joining us for this inquiry into the Reagan administration.
Thank you very much, and thank all of you for coming out on this beautiful morning. I want you to know it wasn't so beautiful when I was leaving the Beltway. It was pouring, but about halfway down, the sky opened and we got to see the sun. It's a tremendous pleasure for me to be here, and I thought what I would do is, rather than make a speech, I'd kind of walk you through the questions, Ken, that you sent me, how I got to know Ronald Reagan and how, once I got to be chairman, how things ran. And then I also wanted to spend a moment telling you, because it really is the product, I think, of the Reagan presidency, the method that I can't say we anymore since I've retired, but that the Republican Party uses in approaching presidential campaigns. We approach presidential campaigns from a strategy standpoint totally different than the Democrat Party, and I think perhaps that's why, as a minority party, which we still are, we've won 5 out of the last 6 races. First of all, I went to law school at the University of California, Berkeley, as a somewhat moderate Republican, but I was there during the free speech movement, and my wife and I came out as hard conservatives after seeing what happened at Berkeley for 3 years, and I then went back to Nevada and started practicing law. One of my dearest and closest personal friends and colleagues in politics for the last 25 years is Senator Paul Laxalt of Nevada. And I first met Paul when he was the lieutenant governor of this, actually when he was running for lieutenant governor. It's an interesting story. Paul was the candidate for lieutenant governor of the state of Nevada, and the gubernatorial nominee of the Republican Party was an old cowboy actor named Rex Bell, who was married to Clara Bow, and I hadn't thought about this, but Paul's been around a lot of cowboy actors. I'm going to get him down here, and you can ask him about that association. But about 6 weeks before the election, God rest his soul, Rex Bell died of a heart attack. And Paul was still the lieutenant governor. There was no way that he would then suddenly move up and become the gubernatorial candidate. A runoff had to be held, and somebody else ran it. Democrat actually won the governorship, but Paul won the lieutenant governorship, and then 4 years later went on and became the governor of the state. And it was during that period of time that that I met Ronald Reagan for the first time. Those of you who have been to the Reno, Lake Tahoe area know what a beautiful spot it is. And the line between Nevada and California runs right down the middle of the lake. And at that time, both states were very concerned about saving Lake Tahoe from pollution and overdevelopment. And so these two neighboring governors, Ronald Reagan and Paul Axalt, decided that they would work together on a compact to between the two states to save the lake, and they became close personal friends. They had known each other, of course, back earlier in history, in 1964, during that race for the White House, when Paul lost the governorship. Paul had actually run for the Senate back then and lost by 86 votes. The United States Senate against Senator Howard Cannon. And it was sort of one of those things where an extra ballot box was found on the west side of Chicago, which just happened to be outside of Las Vegas. The same thing. And there were 86 votes and it defeated him. But these two men working together became very close friends. And Governor Laxalt would very often have Governor Reagan over at political events in Nevada, and that's when I first got to know the governor. I then really began my active political years then. I, in the late 60s, became the chairman of the Reno Young Republicans and then became the national committee man of the Young Republican organization in the state of Nevada. And then in 1971, I ran unsuccessfully for the national chairmanship of the National Young Republicans. I was defeated by a fellow who's a good friend of mine and a congressman now from Tennessee, Donald Sundquist. And Don and I campaigned all over the country against each other. And you might be interesting to know that one of the reasons that I lost was that somebody unit ruled California against me. So that while I had a good portion of the votes in California, she unit ruled it against me. Her name was Maureen Reagan. It's a true story. True story. We were on the other side of the fence in those days. I then became involved in what we would call the senior party in Nevada. Senator Laxalt had decided to, then Governor Laxalt, retire. And he retired from the governorship after 4 years and was out of politics. We then, the two of us, decided that we had to do something about politics in our state, and we convinced Paul to run for the United States Senate, and he ran and won again. We called him Landslide Laxalt because he won his Senate seat by 625 votes. But that got him to Washington as a United States Senator. His close relationship with Ronald Reagan continued. As you know, even though Gerry Ford was in the White House at that point in time and was up for re-election or for renomination, Paul had the courage, and it took a lot of courage, to have a sitting president on the other side, because Paul announced that he was going to chair the Reagan for Presidency Committee in 1975, leading into the Kansas City Convention. Which he did unsuccessfully in a close election at the convention. You'll remember that Gerry Ford was renominated, and then, unfortunately, we lost that race to Jimmy Carter. And the American people saw the illogic in that very, very quickly. And then in 1980, Paul again assumed the chairmanship of the campaign. And we were successful in winning the landslide over Carter. It was at that point when the new administration was being put together that I was approached Now, at that time, I had become the chairman of the Nevada Republican Party in 1975, and in 1977, I became the chairman of all the Western Republican chairmen. And then in 1980, I became the chairman of all the Republican state chairmen in the country. I was approached of whether or not I would like to move to Washington and become the national chairman of the party. And I said, thanks, but no thanks. My kids were still at an age that I just couldn't do it, and my law practice was going well. And if you've ever been around Lake Tahoe, it's a nice place to be around. And San Francisco is 3 hours away by car and 45 minutes by plane, and I enjoyed my lifestyle. And I said no. And at that point in time, a young attorney from Utah, who'd worked very hard for Ronald Reagan for a long, long time, Richard Richards, became the chairman of the party. The 1982 November elections did not go well. You may recall, we got our clock cleaned, as they say. And I was the chairman of all the chairmen at that point in time, and I got a call on the Wednesday after the Tuesday election in November of 82 from the White House asking me to come back to Washington on Saturday to brief President Reagan at a luncheon as to what had occurred in the country. And I said, gee, I don't want to do that. I'm leading a delegation of Republican state chairmen the following Monday to go to Taiwan on a 10-day trip, leaving from San Francisco. And if I had to come back to Washington and spend the day, and Sunday I'd have to fly all the way back. And I said, you can get somebody else to do that. But they were very insistent. Now, you have to come back. Well, I got sandbagged. As soon as I got in the White House, the man popped the question. And you do not say no to a president of the United States. Or if you do say no, you only get to say it once. And I then became... the chairman of the National Committee, with a very unique twist. There was a great deal of planning and strategy that went into it, because if you think back, many people have probably forgot it. What we structured in 1983 was a two-tiered party arrangement. Paul Laxalt was known as the general chairman of the Republican Party, while I was the chairman of the Republican National Committee. There had never been a, quote, general chairman of either party before that. And what our logic was that we were, of course, hopeful that Ronald Reagan was going to seek re-election in 1984, but we had no guarantees. I mean, he would not tell any of us or commit to any of us that he was going to seek re-election. We felt it was very, very important to make sure that we had tied together the leadership of the Republican National Committee, the Republican Senatorial Committee, which is a freestanding committee with its own budget and fundraising, and the House, the Republican House Congressional Committee. And since Paul really acted, as Ronald Reagan's eyes and ears on the Hill, he was, quote, the president's best friend. I mean, a lot has been written about that, and that's why it's so very important that you get him here. Because if you were to develop this without Paul Laxalt, you really would be missing an inside story of the Reagan years, how he got there and what happened during those years. This gave Paul the opportunity to start preparing for the 84 campaign, pulling all the loose ends together at the same time that we were using party funds, not illegally, no impropriety involved, but it gave us an opportunity to make sure that we had total control of the party going into 1984, and it worked very well. As party chairman, and I'm trying to be responsive to the questions that you... I worked very, very closely with the then political operatives in the White House. The telephone call, I didn't get in to see Ken until just a few minutes before I walked into this room, because I was on the phone with a reporter from Washington who was saying, don't you find it unusual in the Bush White House that they don't have a strong political director in the White House, that the person in the White House does not have the same access that Lynn Nofziger and Ed Rollins and those people had prior? And I did not know that the White House political director doesn't even sit in today on the senior staff meetings. I, however, had a very close working relationship with Nofziger and Ed Rollins, who followed him later in that job, and who were very involved on a day-to-day basis with planning. As chairman of the party, I sat in every week to 10 days on a meeting in the cabinet room. It's called the Republican Policy Committee. Every week to 10 days, we would meet from about 9 o'clock in the morning to 10:15 in the cabinet room. The president would sit in the center. To his right would be Bob Dole as the Republican leader in the Senate, Bob Michael on his left, representing the House, and then their deputies, whether it was Al Simpson, and their key committee chairman. There'd usually be about seven senators, Republican senators, and also Bob Michael would be there at the time with Trent Lott and Jack Kemp and Dick Cheney, who were his principal leaders at that point in time in 1983, and around the table. On the other side of the table, Vice President Bush used to sit directly across from the president, and then the rest of the table would be filled in by other congressmen and senators. Behind the president would sit his staff, chief of staff and principal people. On the other wall, behind the vice president, would be myself and usually the Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, other cabinet members, depending upon what the hot subject matter going on in the Hill was at the moment. If it was a matter of dealing with the crisis in the Middle East, and we may be getting a briefing from the Secretary of Defense, or if it was an economic matter, you might have Don Regan there as the Secretary of the Treasury at that particular time, and the briefing would go on. And that was a regular thing during the 6 years that I was the chairman of the party, every week to 10 days, so that at least the leadership of the Republican Party on the Hill would in fact try to work together to the extent that they were able to. And it was an interesting experiment to watch, or experience to watch, Ronald Reagan during those meetings. You've all heard the criticism, which I've always felt to be unfounded, well, that Ronald Reagan had to have his cards, and if he didn't have his cards there, he didn't know what to say, and it was the cards that told him, you know, what to do and how to do it. Well, he would always come in, and a remarkable man with that sparkle in his eye, and always a joke to start us off, and he would have an opening statement, and as you know, he did read from cards, but that statement would set forth what his message was to the leadership. But then it was an open to and fro discussion, and anyone who thinks that Ronald Reagan could not, without his cards, make very clear where he was on such issues as increased taxes, or whether he was going to veto something. He didn't read the card, need the cards to tell you. And I'll tell you, more than one time I saw him take off the reading specs, and I saw him go down on the table and go up and hit the top of the ceiling in the cabinet room. He was very forceful, knew what he believed in, knew what he wanted to see accomplished, and was a very, very strong leader in that regard. I don't think that there is any question that the team around the president in the first 4 years was more effective than the team that surrounded him in the second. There was a great deal of criticism of the so-called triumvirate approach of Baker and Meese and Deber when they first went in 81. But let me tell you something. The first 4 years, a great deal was accomplished in turning around policies that had gone the other way for a long time, and it was very productive. But being chief of staff of the President of the United States is the most thankless job. Most people don't realize it. I mean, you never have a day off. You never have an hour off. You're always on call. There's no such thing as going away for the weekend. You're always there. And very, very tough job. And I thought that Jim Baker did an absolutely marvelous job. I'm also one who... Don Regan is a friend of mine, And I thought Don Regan brought some excellent skills to the job. But because it's a tough job, you also have to have a temperament to deal with it. And I think that if there was anything, I guess it's pretty hard to be a colonel in the Marines and also have run Merrill Lynch and then suddenly get there and have to be involved in the give and take that, that is involved in politics. But I think that his leadership, you know, will always be under the shadow. I haven't read Nancy's book yet. and I'm a little worried about what she's going to say. I'm sure she's not going to say nice things about Don Regan. And there was no question that there was a great deal of friction. In fact, there was a week, I won't tell you what the issue was. You know, everyone in Washington wants to be in the loop. I got to be in the loop. Well, there was one week that I was the loop between Nancy Reagan and Don Regan. They weren't talking to each other, and so she'd call me, Frank, would you tell him that? And then I'd call him, you tell her. And I said to myself, I got to get out of this loop. I'm in harm's way in that loop. And I did get out. I got out as quickly as I can. But that was unfortunate that happened. One of the things that we developed early, starting in 83, was the planning for the 84 election. And the reason I want to get to that now is because I want to tell you the philosophy and approach that I think our party has developed, the Republican Party. The initial planning was really done by five of us. Senator Laxalt and I, Mike Deaver, Jim Baker, and my good friend and pollster for my years there, Richard Werfelin, who polled for Ronald Reagan. It started with him in California and then continued that polling when we were in the White House. And the five of us started meeting on a regular basis in 1983, a full year before, and actually before the president actually told us he was going to go again. And we began our strategy and our polling, and then it slowly, you know, we widened the organization and got ready. Now let me tell you how we approach, because it's so very different. And I had to chuckle to myself. Let me tell you when I knew that we'd won the 88 election. If you remember, Michael Dukakis left Atlanta in their convention with a 17-point lead. And I knew we had won the election when he said, and I'm going to conduct a campaign in every state in this union, a 50-state campaign. As soon as I heard that, I chuckled to myself and I said, this campaign's over if he really intends to do that. You may remember Richard Nixon said that when he ran against John Kennedy. I'm going to campaign in all 50 states. And he did, and he lost, because that is not the way you put together a presidential campaign. I don't know whether it was through the ingeniousness or mischievousness of our founding fathers, many who came from this wonderful commonwealth, when they created the Electoral College. But the Electoral College makes presidential politics as different from every other type of elective politics in this country as apples and oranges. The general rule, as you know, whether you're running for a county commission seat or the United States Senate seat, is he or she who gets the most votes wins. That is not the rule in presidential politics. And we've had some occasions in our nation's history when you could get the most popular votes and lose, and that's happened. That's because of the Electoral College system. So we in the Republican Party approach presidential campaign planning with the Electoral College in mind, and the popular vote is just there as a mechanism to get to the Electoral College strategy. We never in our planning, certainly starting in 1980, in 84 and 88, faced the question of campaigning in every state on an equal basis. In 1984, through that early research starting in 83, in 1988, with the research that I started in early 87, we isolated respectively 27 states in 1984 and 25 states in 1988, where we determined that between 75 and 85% of our resources would be spent. Our time, energy, and financial resources would be spent. That doesn't mean that the other 25 states are totally disregarded. They aren't, but they sort of get the back of the campaign's hand. For example, I'm a Nevada. Well, let me tell you, if a Republican candidate can't win Nevada, they're not going to win the election. I mean, it's just that simple. You don't have to put a lot of time and energy and resources in Nevada, in Utah, in Wyoming. I mean, those are conservative Western states that are going to go for a conservative candidate. So we end up taking what is a universe of 50 states in the District of Columbia and narrowing the universe for targeting purposes. We're now down at 25 states. Let me use that number. It was 27 in 84, 25. In 88, it was 25 states that had 362 electoral votes. And remember, we're looking for 270 electoral votes. So we decided we're going to concentrate 75 to 85% of our time, energy, and resources in those 25 states. Now, we still narrow it. We know from history that the Democratic Party could nominate Genghis Khan, and Genghis Khan will get 40% of the vote in those 25 states. And whoever the Republicans nominate will get roughly 40% of the vote. You just start off with that as a given. Each party has a base of approximately 40% of the vote. Think back. In 1964, Lyndon Johnson crushed Barry Goldwater. Barry got, the numbers are probably in about 38.4% of the vote. When Richard Nixon crushed McGovern, who got the lowest count in many, many years, McGovern got about 37.5% of the vote. When Ronald Reagan defeated Mondale in 84, running up the biggest electoral vote, victory, 525 electoral votes, won every state but Minnesota in the district, Fritz Mondale got about 43% of the vote. So I don't care who it is, we in our planning assume now in those 25 states that we're concentrating that whoever the Democrat is going to get 40, and whoever the Democrat is going to get 40. That's the base. So what are we focusing on in those 25 states? We're focusing on 20% of the vote, and only 20% of the vote. And that 20% is very interesting. Usually that 20% of the vote are people who don't care about party label. They don't care about Republican or Democrat. Those people who care about that are in the 40 on either side. Our job is to focus on that 20%. Now, also, our research data has told us a great deal over the past 30 years. And it is this, and while it'll vary from state to state by a few percentage points, let me speak in some generalities. That of the 20%, roughly 5% of the 20% will define themselves as conservatives, philosophically, on three issues. National defense, spending, and foreign policy. Domestic spending, foreign policy, and defense, domestic economy. They say, I'm not a Democrat, not a Republican, but I am conservative on those three issues. 2% of that 20% will describe themselves as being liberal on those three issues. Now, knowing that, our initial attack always, and if you go back and were to look at our campaign advertising, some of it generic advertising, some of it issue-specific and candidate-specific, in both 80, 84, and 88, all three races, you will see that the first salvos coming out of the Republican side are, this is a choice for the American people between a conservative Republican and a liberal Democrat. And we pound that, and we pound that, and we pound that. Because you see, if we're successful in getting that message out, what happens? Well, that 5% of the 20% falls our way without a great deal of dedication of resources. We lose the 2%. But we're now at 45 to 42. There's only 13% of the vote now left to focus on, and we don't even have to win a majority of the 13% to win the campaign. We don't have to win 6% of it. So all our advertising, all our direct mail and everything is then aimed and targeted down at that 13% with the goal of winning 6. It's just a totally different approach than going out and thinking that you're just going to deliver a broad message to everyone. You must target, particularly if you're a minority party, and you must have to do that kind of plan. Well, as you know, it worked extremely well in 80 and 84 and 88. And without the Democrats changing their party rules, I don't see how they're going to win the presidency in the near future. Their rules are made up in such a way that a Northeast liberal has all the advantages. I mean, a conservative, I mean, a Chuck Robb or a Sam Nunn, or so what we define as conservative Democrat, really, on their system, don't stand a chance in winning the nomination under the present Democrat rules. And as you know, there has been a split. I was at a analysis of the presidential race at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard in December, and most of the leadership of the Democratic Party was there along with us, and they got in a roaring fight between them. We Republicans just sat and watched over whether the party rules should be changed in the Democratic Party, and they're not going to be. Although Bob Beckett, who was Walter Mondale's campaign manager in 1984, jokingly said he was going to nominate me to be the chairman of the Democratic Rules Committee. I told him he didn't want to do that because I wasn't necessarily going to change them the way he thought I would. So the system and approach is so very important. And that is what we were doing in 1983, preparing for that 84 race. And we laid out that sort of strategy and approach. President Reagan is a remarkable man, just truly a remarkable man, with a man comfortable with himself. I mean, I think you saw that the other day when he got on that airplane after this operation. He took the baseball hat off. I mean, Nancy wasn't too happy about it. And his head had been, you know, he had the hair on one side and he was bald on the other. I mean, here's a man who, you know, doesn't care that how funny that looked. He knew himself. His could take his ego and push it down. And he was that sort of a person to work with. Plus, I think there's something about the man's metabolism. I can remember the 84 campaign. It was Cinco de Mayo, which is, if you've ever been out in the West and Southwest particularly, it is a Mexican holiday on May 4th. And we were in San Antonio, Texas with the president. We had flown in from Washington. He was going to address a Cinco de Mayo event. It must have been 120 degrees in the shade. He had a dark suit on with a bulletproof vest under it. He was up on the stage, and it was one of those things where the band members, you know, they were out in the crowd and they were passing out left and right. It was outside. It was not inside the event. And he was up on this stage, and, you know, they were giving him Mexican hats and syrup, you know, that you go through with, you know, 8 more years and all that kind of stuff. It was so warm that I remember that Mike Deaver and Jim Baker and I had not even gone out front. Behind the stage, there was a big tree, and they had some lemonade there, and we were sitting under this tree in the shade. I came around, Ronald Reagan doesn't sweat. I mean, he was up there and there was no sweat. He stood up there, went through this hour-long ceremony. People are dropping, everyone is soaking wet, and there's something about the man's metabolism that has led him at so late in life assume the toughest job in the world. and be able to do it the way that he did, always in good humor. I must tell you, however, that the Iran-Contra controversy, I think, hurt the president personally very badly. He felt let down. It provided a means whereby those who would attack him and didn't like him were given the opportunity to take cheap shots, in my view, that he didn't know what he was doing, oh, he probably slept through it and so forth. I was in a lot of meetings with him. Never saw him fall asleep in the cabinet room or elsewhere. Although some of those meetings were boring, I think I fell asleep on some of them. But I think it hurt him. It hurt him inside. He felt that he had been let down. And of course, he was a president who enjoyed such tremendous popularity with the American people, regardless of where he might have been on issues. That's what is so interesting, I think, right now in the current controversy. For example, the abortion issue has become such a hot issue. It's an issue in this state and in this campaign. It's an issue in New Jersey and the gubernatorial campaign there now. It's an issue all over the country. Ronald Reagan was always clear where he was on the issue. He said, I'm not free choice. I'm against abortion. Yet people could still vote for him. Now, my own view of it is that the American people viewed Ronald Reagan as being a man of tremendous principle, and he stood for something. You didn't necessarily have to agree with that view. But I think when Americans go into the privacy of that voting booth and they're voting for president, I think that probably their party plays less of a role than it does elsewhere. That most American men and women go in there and say, I want to vote for someone who's going to lead this country and who stands for something. And Ronald Reagan, probably more than any in recent times, you always knew that he had strong principles and stood for something, even if you were on the other side. And that's why he was able to win a majority of women voters, even though he was, viewed in some of those polls that you would look at as being against many of the things that the majority of women stood for, the so-called gender gap. And I think that was a very unusual attribute that he had in his presidency, that helped him weather some of the storms among the American people. We're going to see now whether or not the same holds true for President Bush. I was just telling Ken, I heard on the radio on the way down, I was listening to a drive from Washington, there was a report in a new poll that he had dropped 10 points in the last week, and that they attributed it to no action in Panama, and this whole question of the abortion issue where he says he's going to veto this bill. Of course, it was a Boston Globe poll, so I'm going to have to wait to see what the other polls say, but that's a very unique characteristic of Ronald Reagan. I think what I'll do is I'll stop there and just please, anything that you might be curious about or want to know, rather than my just rambling on. But I thought I would. I feel that this approach to presidential politics is very important because it came from the Reagan presidency. It was the strategy that led to his initial election. It led to his re-election, and again was used again most effectively in the 88 campaign.
May I ask the first question just and push you just a little further beyond what you said before we came in on one aspect? You said that with the Panama Canal activity, if I understood it, that you thought President Reagan's action might have been a little different. My initial reaction was that I tended to believe a couple of fellows who were down there when they say that situation was terribly confusing and ambiguous. Dick Cheney has been here about three times, and Brent Scowcroft co-chaired a national commission we had on presidency and science advising, and they're such honorable people, and they're so clear-headed and clear-thinking. that I believe them, and I also was in the infantry in World War II, and I know how absolutely confusing those situations are. And yet, you may be right when you say that either people would have thought President Reagan was going to do something, or he would have taken Noriega out.
I think he would. I think he was tremendously frustrated by the Panama situation, and certainly George Bush's. He was frustrated by it. And I tend to agree with you. I happen to think that Brent, and particularly Dick Cheney, are two of the real shining stars of my party. But I think that Ronald Reagan's approach to things of that nature were very much like his approach to Grenada, for example. Limited downside and an opportunity to do something that if you're going to be a leader, windows of opportunity open and then they close. And a leader knows when to go through the window. And I don't know any more than I've read in the newspaper about what happened. But just knowing the president, having been around Ronald Reagan, I think that as soon as he received news that a coup was underway and they had in their possession somebody, Noriega, that he was for 2 hours or 3 hours, however long it was, the coup leaders had him. I just think that Ronald Reagan would have said, go. And they would have gone over it, and they'd have got him and dragged him out. And who the hell would have been there to defend this drug runner and this murderer that was something we shouldn't have done? Sure, we would have had the normal hue and cry. But, you know, that's just my perspective of being from being on the outside. I just think he would have done that. Ricardo Arias Calderon, who was the leader of the Christian Democrats in Panama, I visited Panama in 1984, and I met with Noriega, and I met with the then president. I was down there to meet with the leaders of the Republican Party, which was the party not of Noriega, but of the president, who was not of Noriega's party. And I met with Arias Calderon, and he told me at that time of the difficulty and how bad Noriega was. Well, the 2 days after the failed coup, I saw him on CNN. He was one of the two vice presidential candidates who won the election that Noriega overturned. And he said something that I thought was very prophetic. And while we're very sensitive to the Latins' view of us, Yankee go home view, he said, if a dog barks a lot, it better have teeth, or it should stop barking. And what he fundamentally was saying was that this administration, I believe, and I agree with him, led officers in the Panamanian Defense Force to believe, I think, that, gee, if you act, you throw this rascal out, we'll be there to help you. And what he was saying is, well, some did. And whether or not the United States didn't have enough sufficient intelligence because of their own weakness, our deficiency as to what we should have known and been able to pass to Dick Cheney or Brent Scowcroft, whether we were deficient, you know, we led those people to believe that if they moved, we would help. And I've got to believe we knew something. We barricaded two roads that were coming in, didn't do the third. I mean, so the information we're getting out now is confusing, and I don't have any more than you do. All I know is what I read in the paper. But I just, knowing Ronald Reagan, I just think that he probably would have moved. You know, I'm a great supporter of George Bush, and I'm not in any way criticizing him. I'm just saying, when questioned, I think Reagan would have done something. George Bush in the long run may be right. It was too confusing, or the cost in human life, American lives, would have been too high. That's a judgment only presidents can make. But having been around both men, they are different men, and their approaches to problems are different.
Could I ask just one last follow-up to it? Russell Riley, behind you, had looked up a lot of research material before your visit, and in '84, you were dealing with people like Viguerie, who were beginning to say, this president isn't strong enough, isn't to say, most of it was aimed at social issues and what he mm-hmm. hadn't done. But when does the Korean airline thing occur? And isn't there also the side of Reagan that you can sum up in the word restraint? And how does the restraint relate to this decisiveness and saying let's go?
That's really what I'm saying. In making a decision of when to move, you've got to weigh the upside and the downside. And I think one of the things that Ronald Reagan always did was to weigh very carefully. There's a difference between being dumb and pugnacious and being smart and pugnacious. And if you're pugnacious and you're smart, you know when to move. You've weighed very carefully. Hopefully you've got good intelligence and know how to move. And that's what he did in Grenada. Obviously with the KAL, that was not involved. When you bring up Richard and you bring up Howie Phillips, people I've known for a long time, and I've said this publicly, I never thought that they spoke for a very large constituency, that they were only interested in their own affairs, and that it was in their own personal best interest to be in opposition and to criticize. And I'm not speaking out of school because I've told that to their face many, many times. No one would ever satisfy them. They would always criticize because they're interested in developing their own little constituency who they could write letters to. Hopefully the money would be sent back to them. So I don't think, and I've got to be very honest to you, that the Vigories and the Howie Phillips of the world ever played a part in moving us one way or another, or moving Ronald Reagan with their criticism. I mean, those two said some of the worst things about Ronald Reagan that I've heard anyone say about a sitting president. I mean, Democrats didn't say some of the things about President Reagan that he did. But it's a question of having judgment of when to move and when not to.
Somebody else.
Exercising my reputed knowledge of restraint. I'm very hesitant to walk in where the lines have been moving. I have tremendously impressed with the priorities and that you assigned to strategic planning, how we have used the mechanism in order to achieve the desired political result. While you were discussing this, I just wondered why, when it's been so effective on a national basis, when it gets into legislative campaigns, it seems to be diluted to such an extent that it doesn't achieve the desired result. Would you comment
sure,
on that?
Sure, sure will. First of all, again, remember, take that presidential race because of the Electoral College and put it off in another world. It's very, very unique. And you can use that sort of strategy for it. The failure of the Republican Party in state legislatures is a direct result of why the Democrats have controlled Congress, because Congress is the product of state legislatures. The Republican Party, and I was part of it at the time, was totally deficient, excuse me, between 1975 and 1980 in preparing for the 80s. If you were to go back and look at the political literature during that time frame, you would read story after story that went something like this. The American people are becoming mobile and are becoming migratory. People are moving from the heavily industrialized upper Midwest and Northeast, and they are moving to, quote, the Sun Belt, unquote. And that as a result of this movement, there would be a dramatic change in American politics following the 1980 census and the 1981 reapportionment process. And how that would take place would be that the more liberal states in the Northeast and upper Midwest would be losing representation in the House after the 80 census. And the states that would be picking up new House seats would be those in the Sun Belt. And those states tend to be philosophically more conservative. And therefore, the rationale was that that would inure to the benefit of the Republican Party being, quote, the conservative party. Well, I think that the leaders of our party believed that and were not prepared for what occurred in 1981 and really started much too late in getting ready for the 1981 reapportionment process. In most states, and it varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, the members of the state legislature draw the congressional lines and districts that govern for the next 10 years the nature, scope, and demographics of congressional districts in the state. And they do that based upon the population results of the census. Well, what the Republican Party didn't realize and get to work on, it was that in the late 70s, most of the state legislatures in this country were controlled by the Democratic Party. And that the Democratic Party, when it sat down, drew districts that protected Democrat candidates for Congress. And sure, Sunbelt states picked up House seats, but there wasn't any way that a Republican was going to win those House seats. And therefore, the decade, I said when I was elected in 1983, there's no way the Republican Party is going to control the House of Representatives in the decade of the 80s. Impossible. Could not be done. Impossible. So the only way that the Republican Party is going to do a better job in the House and become competitive in the House is that the Republican Party has to do a better job in state legislatures, in making sure that we control state legislatures, because they're the ones who are going to draw the lines. Now, I spent a lot of time in my 6 years focusing in governors, because in most states, my goal when I left was to be in a position where particularly the Sun Belt states, those states that were going to pick up seats in the 1991 reapportionment process, we would have a Republican governor and at least a third of one of the houses to sustain a veto of an egregious gerrymander put together by Democrats. That was particularly in the South, because as you know, while Republican candidates have been successful in presidential races and tremendously successful in the last few years, and in Senate and House races in the South, at the local level, there's only been one party for 100 years. It's in the Democratic Party. And if you wanted to be involved in who your sheriff was going to be, and I mean, if we're really going to talk about political power, we're talking about a sheriff, and that's real power historically in this country, or you wanted to know who your mayor was going to be or be involved in local party, you had to be a Democrat. If you were a registered Republican in states that had registration by party, you were out of it. I mean, not only didn't you have a party organization, you didn't have any candidates running, because usually in most of the Southern local races, it was all D's on the ballot. So many, many people would go out and register as Democrats, where it was registration by party, participate in the process. Sure, they might vote for a Republican for president, but that was easy to do. So that is still something that we fight in the South in getting control of Southern state legislatures. You look at the strong support of Republican states for Republican presidential candidates, and then go in and look at the makeup of their state legislatures. Overwhelmingly. Now, we did very well during my chairmanship. I put a lot of time and energy and resources there in picking up, while I was chairman of the governorship of North Carolina, South Carolina, Florida, Alabama, Texas, Oklahoma. We picked up New Mexico. We picked up Arizona for a short period of time. And we lost it. And picked up California. And I concentrated there because those are the Sun Belt states that are going to pick up seats in the legislature. And in most of those states, we've slowly been picking up House seat or state legislative seats so that we would be in a position to sustain a veto by a Republican governor of an egregious gerrymander. But the real problem that the party has is the result of Watergate. I haven't really spoken about this. I'm writing an article out, but I'll speak about it now. It took the Republican Party until 1986 to get back to where we were in the state legislatures of this country immediately prior to Watergate. Everyone talks about the impact of Watergate being on the presidential level and the congressional level, and while that was devastating, let me tell you where it really hurt. It hurt at the local level. We lost over 3,000 legislative seats, I think the number is, in the aftermath. Now, where do you get, what's the farm leagues for future Senate candidates, congressional candidates, governors, attorney generals? The farm leagues in most states, the state legislatures, the courthouse. You have men and women who get elected to the state and serve a term or two, get some experience, then they either run for attorney general, they run for Congress, or they run for governor. We in the Republican Party had a whole generation of potential congressional and senatorial candidates wiped out by Watergate. And I'll challenge you to do something. If you were to go back and look in 1986 and 1988 and look down at those Democrats who ran for the United States Senate in those 2 years, and you look at the Republicans who ran in those 2 years, you're going to find something very remarkable. Most of the Senate candidates of the Democratic Party were ex-governors or attorney generals in their states or congressmen who were stepping up. They had served, they'd been in the public spotlight serving and stepped up to become a United States Senator. You look down at the Republican candidates, it's amazing how many first-timers, men and women who had never served in a state legislature, had never been a governor. And you know, if you've got a governor, sitting governor running for the Senate against someone who's never served, I mean, right away you get the experience issue shoved right down your throat. So that's an excuse, though, sir, that I've given you. I'm trying to explain what has happened. That's why we spent so much time in my 6 years, and I hope that it's continuing, and I can't tell you because I'm not there day in and day out with the new administration, of building county party organizations. I've always felt that that was the building block. If you have a strong county organization, which is usually the lowest common denominator in political building, then strong counties produce strong legislative candidates. You have a strong party organization in the state, and that creates a stronger party. But that's the weakness, and that's the difference between presidential politics and legislative politics.
Thank you. I've overcome my restraint. I'd like to ask, another question to put the focus on the presidency. You have said several times that all you knew about the situation with what you read in the paper.
I'm being a little modest.
It's your modesty that I wish to probe. Considering what the general public, the intelligence of the information that they receive through the media about the president, and your having known him and worked with him so closely, if you were going to indicate two or three of the most important discrepancies as you see it, you've mentioned some about going to sleep, about
yes,
cards and so on. Would you develop that a little bit further? My fundamental question is the media, for partisan reasons or others, or the limitation of economic resources, really projecting the posture of the president on a personal character basis as you saw it?
No, I don't think they do, but I also don't think that the vast majority of them do it intentionally. We're all products of our environment, the way we were brought up, and what we believe in. The vast majority of men and women who are in the media are liberals. That they are liberal in their approach to life. And that creeps into their work. I really believe that the overwhelming majority try to be fair. Try to be fair. But we all are human beings, and what we believe and creeps into what we report. I'm often asked, who's your favorite media person. And many people are surprised by my answer. I say my favorite is Sam Donaldson. And they say, well, he was so terrible to President Reagan. He was so how can he be your favorite? And I'd say, because Sam Donaldson is consistent. He's miserable to everybody. Now, what I mean by that is if Sam is interviewing Ronald Reagan or George Bush, sure, he's going to be miserable to them, he's going to be rude to them, he's going to be tough on them, but he's the same way to Democrats. Ted Kennedy's there, he's just going to be just as miserable, and that is fairness to me. What bothers me is that there are many reporters, again, I don't think they do it intentionally, it's built into their system, I guess, as human beings, who will be miserable to a Ronald Reagan or George Bush, and then turn around, and they're not equally as miserable to the other side. I think what we want is not someone who favors us, we want someone who treats both sides the same way. Now, I must tell you that I am not one who rails against the press. And say, oh, the press is so unfair. A lot of Republicans, I've always felt, make a big mistake. All they do is whine and cry about the press. I think that's a mistake. My philosophy has always been, when I was a state party leader and during the time I was a national party leader, is look, they're a given. That's a given in life. Assume that you're going to have these people who are, assume they're well-intentioned, but assume that they have built-in weaknesses and frailties that you're going to have to deal with that, just as you're going to have to deal with other things in life when you're planning your campaigns, when you're running your governorship or your Senate the term or your presidency. Assume it out. That's a given. And deal with it. And prepare for it. And plan for it. And quit whining and crying about it because you're never going to be able to do anything about it. It's a given in life. So that's always been my philosophy and approach. And I must tell you that that approach, it always worked well for me. I mean, and you must treat reporters, men and women, as people. They're out there trying to do a job. They've got families to support. They're doing their best. I think the vast majority. Sure, you have some that may be out there who want to put into their work their own personal views and do things for partisan reasons. That's the exception, not the rule, in my experience.
Next question, General Wilson.
First, a quick comment on Panama and the leadership there. I think the terms you use, you have to be very careful when the job is yours. It's nice for somebody else. Mm-hmm. But you must distinguish between being bold and being reckless. I think it's good to be bold, but you have to...
Exactly right.
And also caution and hesitation. It's good to be cautious, not good to hesitate. But those are fine distinctions, and if you've got the job, it's very
right.
Different than somebody else saying what you should have
and
done.
And we don't have the information to know.
No, but I think yeah. You but on your legislature.
That's what I meant by being pugnacious and smart and pugnacious
yeah.
And dumb.
Well,
you
I
said it a little bit more elegantly. Than
I spent more time thinking about it. on your legislature, what I really wanted to comment on is your legislative in Virginia contradicts everything you've said because, and I've been very active in the Republican Party here, so we had 9 congressmen out of 10 with a legislature which was I think 90 between 90 and 95 93 or something of that Democrat. And the other thing is and the reason for that I think is apparently this it contradicts what you were saying but the reason for it mm-hmm. is that the Virginia Democrats are very conservative. In the county when I was county, I got a very prominent Democrat
sure.
there gave me a check for $25 for Mr. Nixon. He won't vote Republican, but they give money. I got Bill Scott elected.
Sure.
And so on. They will support Republicans and do it.
But you have a tradition. See, each state is different. Each state, even though you have a state right next to you geographically, each state, and that's what the marvelous thing, that's why when people talk about doing away with the Electoral College and all that, I say, no way. That college respects the individuality and tradition of states. And there are many, and Virginia's not alone. There are many states where Democrats are Democrats for their own purposes, but will support. I'm speaking broad generalities when I talk about it. But by the same token, And I'm not taking jibes. I mean, the Republican Party in this state has not done a good job. They gave Chuck Robb a free ride.
I agree.
They gave him a free ride. That's why Belisle is now the governor. And Jerry's a friend of mine. I like him very much personally, but I, you know, my view, that the free ride that the party gave Chuck Robb let Jerry Belisle walk into that governorship. And what happens, though, is particularly in congressional races, they tend to really be decided by local politics, and there's very little that a president can do. If you were to look at just the three specials that we've had in the last year, you had Dan Quayle's seat, which was held by Republicans for years. What happened? A Democrat won it. Trent Lott held that seat down in Mississippi for, 17 years? Democrat won it the other day. Claude Pepper held that seat down in Florida for 200 years, who knows? And what happened? Ross Layton, a Republican, won it. So they really are, and I know that the president and my successor as chairman of the party are going to take some hits. Well, gee whiz, they lost those races. There's very little impact that the national party can make, in particularly in special congressional elections, because you know what determines it? When you start getting down to that level, people know people. They know who they are. They know their family. They know whether they've really been interested in the community. And then the question comes up whether that post office is going to be closed or whether there's going to be an expansion on the Veterans Hospital. I mean, those are really local issues that play a part.
Next question. Yes, Mrs. Elliott.
I want to go back to Richard Vigory,
yeah,
and the PACs who have their own agenda, who are raising their own money, mm-hmm, to do their own thing. How does that dilute or hinder the work of the National Committee or help?
It hurts. I can't tell you how many times I would get calls and letters from someone saying, well, gee, I sent you $1,000 to help you and President Reagan. And turns out they sent it to some United Republicans for victory and, you know, in the world or whatever. And I said, wait a minute, that the United Republicans is not us. And I spent a tremendous amount of time, as did the president. We told people, unless it says Republican National Committee or Virginia Republican Party or Republican Senatorial Committee or Republican Congressional Committee or Republican Women of Virginia or whatever, official organ, don't send it. If you have any questions, call us. And it does hurt. It probably hurts the national party less than it does state parties and county parties, because they're the ones that have the rough time raising that money.
What about their advertising,
too? Oh, it's sometimes very bad. And, of course, what it does is it disrupts. A candidate can have in his mind in a particular state how to run a campaign, and then suddenly there's injected another factor. And the best example I can give you of that, and I guess people can say whether it helped or defeated Mike Dukakis, but those ads that showed Willie Horton's picture, they were not the Bush ads, and they were not the Republican National Committee's ads. We were very careful that we never showed Willie Horton's picture. We never mentioned Willie Horton's name. You cannot find a Bush Quayle ad or Republican National Committee ad that even mentions his name or his color or shows his picture. We were talking about the furlough program and not being able to understand it. These other groups injected it, and then, of course, Dukakis picked it up because he thought he could turn it around and use it to his advantage, and what he did is exacerbate his own problems.
You said the party problem of being concerned about the strengthening and the role of the party, that you and the president were concerned. Could you say just a little bit more about the extent to which the president trouble himself about,
yeah,
party matters,
yeah,
and was he a party leader?
He really, really was. I think George Bush may be better, however, just from the fact that George Bush sat where I sat. In fact, I doubt that, I know he is the only president of either party to have been George Bush, to have been the national chairman of his party. But you know, he was the Harris County, Texas County party. He may also be the only president who's ever been a county Republican chairman. And I mean, that's really getting down where the rubber meets the road. I mean, he understands You know, he's probably been out hammering those signs in the ground. That's what I call a grassroots politician, right? That's the person who starts out by the one, he's the one holding the stake while somebody else is hitting the top. Ronald Reagan's great ability in the party was fundraising. I'm a little embarrassed about it now, but while, during my chairmanship, 6 years, we raised about $360 million. We broke every single record. Ronald Reagan's name was gold on a letter. I mean, every letter I ever sent out with that name, everyone says I wrote every day. I did not, those of you who are on the list, I did not write every day. Every 3 days. No. But he could sign a letter, and I mean, it was like opening a bank door. The money would come in. He had that remarkable ability. He would go out and make a speech somewhere, and it would be sold out within an hour. I mean, this man had that kind of charisma, whatever you want to call it. He would also, anytime I ever asked him to do a special event to raise money for the Governors Association, he would be there. To raise money for State Legislative Association, he would be there. So he was very, very involved. And we had a dramatic impact. The Reagan years changed the makeup of American politics demographically in many ways. It truly was in 81 and even more in 84, or 80 and 84, the breakup of what was the old New Deal coalition of the Democratic Party. We received in 84 a majority of the Italian-American vote that always had been strong Democrat. Irish-American vote, majority. Catholic vote. Hispanic vote. Ronald Reagan in 84 got 45% of the Hispanic vote. Got a third of the Jewish vote. Would have probably have been higher. We were running about 45% of the Jewish vote until the Mondale campaign, if you think back then, ran the Jerry Falwell ads. Do you want Jerry Falwell picking your next, you know, and scared the Jewish community. They ran very heavily that ad in New York and those areas where there were where Jewish voters played a very important part. We ended up with a third of the Jewish vote. The only part of the coalition, that old New Deal coalition that we were unsuccessful in, was black voters. We spent a tremendous amount of time, energy, and resources. We ended up with 9% of the vote. Bill Brock, one of my predecessors, spent 4 years as chairman of the party, a tremendous amount of time, energy, and resources trying to make an impact in the black community, and we failed. And that it's something we're troubled with. We work on very hard, but it's sometimes just like banging your head against the door. George Bush, when he was vice president, went down and spoke the NAACP, I think it was in 86. He walked into the room, was introduced, and the funeral dirge was played by the organ player. I spoke to the NAACP convention in 86. I was on the very same platform where 2 years earlier I had been when we renominated the president and vice president. And when I was introduced, there was some remark made about, now we're going to introduce the chairman of the Republican Party, and maybe now we ought to do the benediction. You know, just, and then as soon as I mentioned Ronald Reagan's name, I had to stand on that podium and have him booed and jeered and said, I stood there. They were, you know, we've worked very hard at it. Now, George Bush, I think, hopefully is going to be able to do a better job at outreach, because he has a very strong civil rights record, and we'll work very hard at it. Ronald Reagan was wrongfully beat, I think, one of the areas in the press. He was constantly beat that he was insensitive to minority needs. Not at all. There's not a prejudice bone in Ronald Reagan's body, in my view, and I've been around him a long time. But he got beat up on that count for a long, long time. But that was the one area that we were unsuccessful. The biggest area was young voters. You know, traditionally, young voters, when I were growing up, the vast majority of them were Democrats. When young people went out and voted for the first time and registered, they were Democrats. Ronald Reagan turned that whole thing on its head. The strongest demographic support group for Ronald Reagan and the Republican Party from 82 on were young voters. I remember when those numbers really started showing up in 83, I went to the president and said, Mr. President, I've got some good news for you and bad news for you. The good news is that you have changed American politics dramatically, that young voters who automatically were Democrats, the vast majority of them are now Republicans. He said, oh, that's great. What's the bad news? And I said, the bad news is they're the worst voters. And they are the worst voters. They have the worst voting record. They don't. And we've spent a lot of time and energy, and we improved the participation of young voters over the years. But the demographic change that we were unsuccessful as a party was among black voters. George Bush, I think the end result was got 13% of the vote in 88, which is still, that's very low. It's unacceptable.
Next question, Howard Cromwell.
I'm talking about the mechanics of elections. I wonder what your judgment would be about the voting machine being a factor here and making more people have the tendency to split their vote. Years ago, when we voted by hand, the ballots, all you had to do is put an X at the top and you voted for every Republican or every Democrat.
Yeah, it's good.
Did that affect this change? Does that affect the coattail factor in presidents' influence?
I really don't think so. If the doing away with it has helped the Republican Party, because some of the places where they really, like Chicago, where they really pulled that one lever, we really got our brains pounded out. Let me try to explain it this way. When I said a little while ago that probably voting for president, party has less to do with how people vote. They go to that booth, and I think most Americans say right now, I'm not just voting for me, I'm voting for my family, the history. I'm going to vote for the best man or woman, and they do that. What happens is, particularly when you get lower down the ticket, when you start talking about voting for state legislature, judges, where they're on the ballot, county commissioners, city council, where they run as partisans, in some parts of the country they do. It is there where party becomes more important. And the reason it becomes more important is that those are the political races that usually get lost in the public perspective because they're overshadowed by the presidential, the senatorial, the gubernatorial races that get all the ink, that get all the television coverage, that get all the press. And while this isn't true in rural areas where people know, but you get in the big city and large metropolitan areas, most of the time people go in and say, well, I know, I heard, oh yeah, Senate. Well, I saw Senator so-and-so debating so-and-so, and I liked what he or she said, and they go, they get down the bottom of that ticket, and they look and say, a choice between Judy Jones, the Republican, and Shirley Smith. But I don't know either of them. I mean, those candidates usually have low budgets. Maybe they got a door hanger from once. Oh, yeah, I remember. I got that cute door hanger that had that little plastic thing that helped me open up the mustard jar when it was, you know, you've all gotten them. And they make decisions less based on that. And they say, well, I don't know either of them, but I'm a Republican. So I'm going to vote for the Republican, or I'm a Democrat, so I'm going to vote for the Democrat. It is at the bottom of the ticket where party affiliation is more important, and why the change wrought by Ronald Reagan, where realignment really is taking place. You know, the new poll that's out, just out in the last week, has 32% of the American people considering themselves Republicans, 32% considering themselves Democrats, and the rest non-affiliated. That is the first time in other, we've been close. In 84, we were close within the margin of polling error. But that's the first time that, this is a survey done by, it's like Gallup or one of the other polling. It's not done by any of us. It's the first time that particular poll has ever showed that we're at the same level. That's very important, and that's where in the long run, I think if we do our homework in preparing for reapportionment in 91 and 90, where it'll pay off by electing more Republicans to the state legislature, so they'll be there drawing the lines for 1991, which will determine the congressional layout.
Frank, you've done very well with Dun and Bradstreet and the cavalry. Now we turn you over to the graduate students.
Sure.
I want to follow up on Mr. Thompson's question, if I may, about President Reagan's party. And as a means really of getting you to comment, I want you, I would ask you to go back and think back to your preparation for the 1986 midterm yep. elections. You know, probably you said you came in 82 after a midterm election, which didn't go so well. Obviously, the 84 elections would have been, the president would have been preoccupied with his own re-election, but by the time you get to 86, you're back in a situation where the president could be utilized to attempt to
yes.
deflect some of these problems that you addressed yep. in terms of the local election. What kinds of strategies were developed, and what
yep.
exactly how did you attempt to go about using them?
And I'm really glad that a graduate student asked that so that history could be set right. if you most people say, oh, gee, 86 was a disaster for the Republican Party because they lost the control of the Senate. The untold story of 1986 was that the Republican Party had a net gain of 8 governors, 7 of whom were in the Sunbelt states. And I must also tell you that the Senate races, and I'll get to those in a minute, of course, weren't my bailiwick. The United States Senate races are handled by a separate freestanding committee that I have no control over. I didn't have any control over. Lee Atwood had any control over it today. Because under the federal election law, we must keep arms distance. They have their own budget and so forth. Ronald Reagan was instrumental in working for the Republican Governors Association, raising money, helped me put together the team. We went out and got good candidates and were tremendously successful in the governor's race. Now let me tell you what happened in the Senate. When Ronald Reagan was elected in 1980, he carried it into office with him. And remember, no one ever thought about the Republicans capturing the Senate meeting, but he brought over the line, I think, 12 wins for Republican Senate candidates where the margin of victory was 1.5% or less. And I've got to be, and I'm not going to name names, but he carried in a lot of turkeys. We see Republicans have turkeys who are elected in the United States Senate, just like the Democrats. And we had a lot of turkeys who got elected, who then had 6 years to become thoroughbred racehorses if they'd done their homework. But we had an awful lot of them who didn't take care of their constituencies, and thought that the last year that suddenly they were going to pay attention to the home folk. I mean, these are people who during those 6 years, on the 4th of July, weren't riding in their local parade at home. They were in Washington watching the fireworks around the Washington Monument. And what happened? These people had to go out and run on their own. Ronald Reagan wasn't on the top of the ticket. And they got beat. And who beat them? You look back at 86, as I mentioned, you're going to find amazing number of Republican, Democrat, former attorney generals and governors, people who were well-prepared candidates who tended to the home fires. We took the president out, though. I went out with him for 2 weeks. And everyone said, well, Ronald Reagan didn't have any coattails because those guys lost, and you lost the Senate. But I'll tell you, he really did, because when we got the president out, there were some of those guys that were down at 42% of the vote. And we went out and did the work, and they finished with 48% of the vote. Ronald Reagan had moved the electorate 6 points, but not enough to get him over the hump. So the president was very, very involved with me at the National Committee, focusing on the governorships, which was my big challenge. And he also attempted, to the best of his ability, to help the party in the Senate races. But there's only so much you can do for a weak candidate. And therefore, we lost some of those states. And those states are, you know, and some of them were southern states. I mean, we lost Georgia. We lost Alabama. We lost in Florida. I mean, there were candidates who had, and then the one who everyone said in 1981 was the first one that was going to get knocked off, the one who really was carried to victory, was a fellow named Alphonse D'Amato in New York, who everyone said, this guy is a buffoon, and the Democrats will knock him off in 6 years. Well, Al D'Amato went out and worked for 6 years. He treated his United States Senate seat, you'd have thought he was a state legislator. He was home every night making speeches. He rode the shuttle back and forth. He worked, and it ended up he got reelected by about what Governor Cuomo got reelected in New York. So the difference there was, and that's why you've heard the joke, you're a realtor. What's the most important three things in valuing a piece of property? Location, location, location. Still in politics, with all the things I've talked about, the most important three things are the candidate, the candidate, the candidate. And even with this description that I gave you of the way we approach presidential races, let me tell you, if George Bush hadn't gone out there on that podium that night in New Orleans and delivered that great speech that he delivered, or Ronald Reagan hadn't been the indefatigable campaigner that he was, all that strategy would have been for naught. You can never replace the candidate. We had weak candidates in the Senate races. In the meantime, we had strong gubernatorial candidates, and that's the answer.
Other questions?
Reference to your statements concerning the Don Regan and Mrs. Regan feud, if that's the right term. I guess most of us here saw Mike Wallace interview Mrs. Regan on 60 Minutes on Sunday night. The subject, he tried to book her on this, and I thought she handled herself and that subject extremely well.
Is the question about Nancy Reagan? Or?
No. The question is about Bush. How close was the Reagan-Bush relationship, if I really had one, to what extent and how well did the president prepare Mr. Bush to become president? I think it's been a very unique situation.
Well, my experience is that he did an extremely good job. I must tell you, however, interestingly enough, that I think the relationship emulated, in many ways, the relationship that Jimmy Carter started. Jimmy Carter, you say what you will about him, and I said an awful lot of things, I hope the Lord forgives me, and I say, I've been saying some things recently, too, because I don't like what he's doing recently, but that's neither here nor there. Jimmy Carter changed the role of the vice president in that he really brought Fritz Mondale within the real tight loop and had him present at national security briefings, had really gave the vice president more to do. It wasn't that warm bucket job that the former vice president from Texas described it as. And that's what Ronald Reagan did with George Bush. All cabinet meetings, NSC briefings, really had him in the loop. And then they themselves originated the weekly luncheon. I mean, there's many times I can tell you that I was in the White House and I'd be walking across the trellised area from the main house to the West Wing, and I think it was Wednesdays at noon, the president and vice president would be alone eating outside, having a weekly lunch where they... just the two of them, no staff, where they interrelated. So I really believe that he did a good job, Reagan, in working with and involving the vice president and help train him. I also think that George Bush was probably the most magnificent vice president that we've had in a long time. What a tough job. What a miserable tough job. I mean, in order to be a good vice president, you must take your own views, your own personality, and in order to serve the man you were elected with and who chose you, you must swallow them. Your job is to be there as part of a team and to assist and to help and aid. And I was present in my party chairmanship role in these policy meetings that I told you about, and George Bush, there could not have been a more loyal, dedicated, helpful vice president than he was. And that's why it's always been so difficult for a vice president, and why so many of us in the party were concerned as to whether or not George could step out from under the shadow of a strong president. It's been most difficult when the president you serve has been strong. I mean, Harry Truman had it. I mean, think back now. No one gave Truman a chance. I mean, people thought, you know, you look back now and you read about him, and everyone says, oh, he was a strong dynamic. I mean, I thought, I kind of liked Harry Truman, looking back and knowing then, because I was a kid. But back then, if you read the literature, it was a joke. Because here was Roosevelt, who was such an overpowering figure. In many ways, Eisenhower was a very popular president, a powerful figure, a great war hero, and Nixon was under... And we were all concerned, could George step out from under that shadow and convince the American people that he himself was his own man. And I think he did. He did a marvelous job in New Orleans. And the campaign of Mr. Dukakis was so miserable that that was a great assist, what George Bush did. And I think that Ronald Reagan, including him and involving him, was one of the reasons he was able to do so. There has not been, in my view, a better prepared president than George Bush. If you think about it.
That was my own feeling, particularly if you go back over all the...
Oh, you go back. I mean, county chairman and national chairman of the party, so the political end. He was a congressman. He was our ambassador to the United Nations. He was our first envoy to China. He was our CIA director. And then 8 years as vice president. I mean, that's not bad training. Has his paw in just about everywhere.
Henry Theobarn.
To what extent is the abortion problem going to become a single issue if we shoot this down?
Well, I tell you, that's the unknown. I think candidates mishandle the issue and are stampeded in the issue, and they shouldn't be. Like school prayer, the abortion issue is an issue that is not a Republican issue or a Democrat issue. It cuts across the fabric of politics in this country. It's not Republican or Democrat or independent. It cuts this way. And I think that candidates, wherever they are on the issue, could learn a lesson from Ronald Reagan. Most of them waffle on the issue. They ought to stand up to the line and say, look, I'm a Catholic. This issue means something to me personally. Here's what I believe, and that's what I believe. I understand people can have the other view, but that's where I believe, and that's my own view. And I think it is people who oppose abortion who tend to end up waffling the most and hurting their campaigns. Ronald Reagan attracted the votes of people who disagreed with him totally on the issue of abortion and school prayer. Because they say, well, you know, I don't agree with him on that, but at least, you know, he believes in it. Let me tell you, these two guys running for governor of this Commonwealth have been all over the lot for years. I mean, it's pretty tough. So I think that if there is a candidate who waffles who waffles on the issue, then they're going to get hurt. They're going to get hurt very, very badly. And sure, if there are people who are single issue voters, they're always going to exist, whether it's abortion, whether it's school prayer, whatever it may be, the so-called social issue, you're going to lose them. But you're not going to win everybody, but stand for something. This is what I believe in. And understand that when you vote for me, this is my belief. I'm sorry, it's part of my makeup, and there's nothing I can do about it. I mean, that's the problem, it seems to me, with candidates, where issues like that hurt them, where they don't convey to the voter that they have any inner strength one way or the other.
Mr. Siebert?
Concerning that 13%,
yes.
How do you go about winning them?
Well, you do it in many ways. Let me give you a good example. And I know we should be talking about Reagan, but I can't give you as fresh an example as I can in the last campaign. Our polling data made very clear to us that in that 13%, George Bush and Republican candidates were losing by about 24 percentage points among women who did not work outside the home. I'm talking about women who were homemakers and who were in the home during the day. For whatever reason, I always thought it was economic. And I started running them between the two conventions. And I saturated these ads during daytime television with some of the game shows in the morning and some of the soap operas in the afternoon and shows like Donahue and Oprah, and where our statistics told us. The two ads, you may recall them. One was an ad which I'm proud of both of them. The second one won the best ad of the year, and the second one won the second best ad of the year. was a little girl sitting on a porch, and she had a coloring book. She was coloring, and the voice said, "This is a very fortunate little girl. During the 7 years of her life, inflation has been down, unemployment, blah, blah." And then you remember the camera came in at the very end, and she looked into the screen with these big blue eyes and said, "Why would we ever take a chance of losing what we've done in the economy?" Because I've always thought that the gender gap is economic-based, not on social issues. The other one was a comical ad. I'd done some research and found that the American people have become so used to seeing color television that if suddenly something's on in black and white, it automatically draws their attention. I mean, we've seen color things so often that something's in black and white, everyone watches it. And I had produced an ad in black and white that was catchy. "I remember you, you're the one who made me feel so blue." And it was in black and white, showed Jimmy Carter's picture. And gasoline lines and so forth, and the voice said, and it said, "Republicans have been working very hard in the last 7 years to make sure that you don't have long lines and unemployment and so forth. Tell them you remember, tell them." It was a little catchy tune. Those ads, we ran saturation. I spent $4 million on them. We saw that 24-point margin that Dukakis had on us among that tier of voters, among 13%, right down to nothing, and switched, and we eventually won a majority of those voters. So you take your advertising, that's just an example that's right in mind, and focus. You deliver your message to those voters.
We're on the point of, I know you've got to run, one last question.
Sure.
You can pass on if you want. Dean Burch and yep. Richard both served on national commissions we had, and we're on the point of a sixth national commission. And we kind of like to talk in more detail sometime, but it is on the selection of presidents and vice presidents, with maybe a little more emphasis on the second. Do you have any thoughts about the way we select and nominate and
yeah, I do.
Pick?
I will tell you, I thought someone would ask, because I've never appeared before anyone, and I'll do it in 5 minutes. The process and how it worked in New Orleans. George Bush called me in to his office about a month before New Orleans, when it was clear that he was going to be the nominee. And he asked me if I would get involved and get a feeling from around the country, Republican leaders, who the vice presidential nominee should be. I know that he also asked Senator Alan Simpson of Wyoming to get the views of members of the United States Senate. I can't remember who he asked in the House, but he asked one of the House members to sort of do a little informal survey among House members, and he asked the chairman of the Republican Governors Association, Governor Mike Castle of Delaware, to do the same among governors. And I spent, and he said, "It's going to be confidential. You're not all going to be called in together. We'll call you in by yourself, and what you tell me will be confidential, and I hope it will remain." And I spent a lot of time on it. And I went in and spent an hour and a half with George Bush about 10 days before New Orleans, told him what I had found out, and I'm not going to tell you the results of that because that's confidential of what I told him. But I gave him my thoughts and what the feeling was of the party chairman and the Republican National Committee, men and committee women around the country, and county chairman, and I'd spend some time on it. I then went off to assume my responsibility of putting on a good convention, which is a tremendous burden, and I did too, and I'm so happy I'm not going to have another one. You have no idea what's involved in one of those. But I went off to New Orleans. The next thing that I heard, which upset me greatly, was that the vice president was going to announce who his running mate was going to be at a breakfast on Thursday morning, the final morning of the convention, of the Texas delegation. Well, when I heard that, I went nuclear. I called Jim Baker. I talked to everyone I could talk to. I talked to those people around the president. And I never did tell the president this directly because he was busy campaigning, but I talked to his people. I said, "That's idiotic." I said, "If he does it Thursday morning, the last day of the convention, then the Friday morning talk shows and the Friday morning newspapers are not going to be focusing on his acceptance speech Thursday night, when he has to step out from under the cloak of Ronald Reagan and show that he's his own man, they're going to be focusing on the vice presidential candidate. And the speech will get lost. My suggestion was that we do what we did in Detroit in 1980. And I don't know if you remember what we did, but when Ronald Reagan went over the top on Wednesday night, we brought Reagan to the convention center in Detroit, and he went out on the podium to the cheering crowds on Wednesday night and said, "Thank you for the confidence you've shown in me, and tomorrow I want you to nominate George Bush as my vice presidential running mate." So that the Thursday morning papers and focus was Reagan wins nomination, selects Bush as his running mate. And then Friday morning focused on the acceptance speech. So I was like, please do that. Please. You know, you got to do that. In the meantime, we were arranging what we called the farewell to Ronald Reagan, the kissing of Air Force One and Air Force Two. And if you remember the convention, George Bush did not arrive. It was not in New Orleans at the opening of the convention, which was on a Monday. That became Ronald Reagan Day. The president had come in on Sunday. We had a big welcoming ceremony for him. And then he addressed the convention on Monday night. On Tuesday morning, the president went out to a naval air station outside of New Orleans. And Air Force One was parked on the ramp. And George Bush flew in with Barbara Bush. And the two airplanes parked like this. And George Bush came down. And Ronald Reagan welcomed him. And they, at that point in time, was the first time, to my knowledge, that George Bush told anybody who his running mate was going to be. He said, "I'm going to choose Dan Quayle." He's admitted he told Reagan. Reagan then went up the ramp, got on the airplane, and flew away to the ranch in California. Vice President Bush then called his traveling party and entourage into a holding room at the Naval Air Station and said, "I want you to get on the phone for me, Jack Kemp, Bob Dole, Elizabeth Dole, Pete DuPont, Paul Axoff, you know, all those people who were being named. I'm going to call them and tell them that it is not them." And to my knowledge, that was the first time he told Jim Baker, Bob Teeter, and people around him, "I'm going to select Dan Quayle." Now, while all this is going on, I am down on the wharf outside the Hilton Hotel with 15,000 screaming people waiting for the riverboat. We took Bush from the Naval Air Station to the river, put him on a Mississippi paddle boat, and we're bringing him down the river to this site outside the Hilton, where I was waiting with this crowd to welcome him to New Orleans as the party chairman. And here I am, dumb and happy, and I'm saying to myself, "I'm going to tell him he's got to wait. Do this, not do it Friday morning, he's got to wait, do it Thursday night." I had in my mind the Marriott where he was staying had a glass elevator. I mean, I had the camera angle that he was going to get in while the votes were being tallied, and he was going to come down in the glass elevator, and he was going to get in the limousine, we'd have a camera on top of the Superdome, and then you know, he'd go closer to over. I mean, I had it all planned. Dumb me, standing there in 8,000 degree humidity. You know, the sweat rolling down, and the Dixieland bands are playing, and suddenly down the river comes the boat, and it docks, and so forth, and I'm waiting there, no George Bush. And suddenly Jim Baker got off the boat and came up to me, and I'll never forget as long as I live. He said, "Frankie, it's Quayle, and the old man wants to announce it right now, and Quayle's out in that crowd somewhere." We can't find him. And if anyone were to go back and look at the tapes of that event, that welcoming ceremony, I'm up on the stage like this. Jim Baker's on one side, and Bob Teeter and Roger Ailes are on the other. And we're looking at what had happened, of course, where these 15,000 people were in there like sardines and had been like sardines for an hour and a half, so that when the Quayles arrived, he didn't have Secret Service at that point in time. I mean, no one knew who he was. And he pulled up, and And finally, after 20 minutes, we found him, and Secret Service got him through, and George Bush made the announcement. The decision, to my knowledge, was made by George Bush and George Bush only. It was totally his decision, and that's the prerogative of the nominee of the party. Whether that should change or it should be done differently, it's right or wrong, I'll be happy to comment if you want to involve me in that study.
We'd like.
But I'm not sure it'll ever change. I'm not sure it will ever change.
The interesting thing, all executive branch people who've had long service and distinguished service say it ought to change. All of you who are the Pauls say it may never change.
Yeah, I doubt it. I think that individuals like George Bush and Michael Dukakis, who go through what you have to go through to be a candidate for the presidency of the United States, and I have just tremendous respect for the winners and the losers. It is a terrible, terrible, tough, tough thing that they go through. And nowadays, you know, you're running for 4 years. I mean, you really are. You don't just run the last 2 years. You're at it all the time. Tremendous burden. And I think they're always going to say, hey, under the system, I've got the right to choose my VEEP, nominate my VEEP, and I'm going to keep that. So all the great thinkers of the world in one room saying, gee, that's not a wise way to do things, will be for naught, in my view. Thanks so very much. It's been a pleasure being with you.